Okay, good evening. Tuesday, November 27th, Rabbi Feldman's here. Tonight's cheer is sponsored by Rachel and Alan Friedman to commemorate the yard site of Rachel's mother, Tova Gittel Bas Rav Yosef David.
Okay, thank you very much. Again, so we're continuing our ongoing Chesed series. So tonight, that puts us up to Nichum Avel. Spoke the past 2 weeks about Bikacholim, before that about Achmasas Orchim, so now about Nichum Avel, and we'll see how many parts there are, if there are too many parts after this series of Chanukah coming up, so that will probably dictate a little detour in any case. At least for tonight, let's look a little bit at this concept of Nichum Avel. So Nichum Avel, again, follows a similar structure to the other mitzvot of Chesed, where again you have the position of the Rambam, that Chesed as a whole is associated with Yahas L'Recha Kamocha, certainly a mitzvah min HaTorah, but that the specific formats were designed midrabbanan, and we've never totally understood what that meant. We discussed a couple of different theories, but essentially it boils down to being a Daraisa-based drabbanan in the Rambam's view. And according to a lot of other Rishonim, it's simply a Daraisa. Whether you say it's a Daraisa because it's Yahas L'Recha Kamocha and not a Daraisa, or whether you say it's because of Balach the Bedrachav. Either way, Rabbi Yonah writes explicitly in his commentary to Maseches Brachos, where he talks about whether one is exempt from Kriya Shema because one's involved in Nichum Avelim. Rambam writes in his commentary to Rambam Sefer HaMitzvos, and a number of others take for granted that this is the case, that we're dealing here with what is essentially HaMitzvah Min HaTorah. And once again, it's another case where HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself modeled this behavior, and we're told that after Avram dies, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes and gives a bracha to Yitzchak, and it's understood by Chazal that that was an act of Nichum Avelim following the passing of Avram. And so once again, as we see with Bikacholim, as we see by Hashem's Arfim, perhaps as we see by so many other acts of Chesed, HaKadosh Baruch Hu directly models them, and the whole realm of Chesed is considered to be the primary arena for the Halakha B'drachah, where we try to imitate HaKadosh Baruch Hu's actions. And when it comes to Nichum Avelim, so you find actually that Nichum Avelim is considered to be special, because as Rambam puts it, it is a chesed not only with the living, it's a chesed with the deceased as well. So what does that mean to say it's a chesed with the deceased? So there is a mystical way of understanding it, and there is perhaps some more down-to-earth, or literally, a way to understand it. On the one hand, there is this idea that the Gemara suggests that for this period of Shiva, the soul is kind of hovering around where he lived, and therefore it is also benefited from the Nechama. And there's another sense, a little more practical, that we know there is a concept of kavod after mesh. We actually, I think we, maybe touch upon this recently, maybe not. For example, the Gemara talks about kibbut av'ayim. So it says, mechavdim, mechayim, mechavdim, mesho. There's a concept of kibbut av'ayim after the parents are no longer alive. And the Achronim explained that it's a whole different model of kibbut. And when parents are alive, so kibbut av'ayim means you have to do what they want, you have to listen to them, you have to do things that make them happy. And the parents are no longer alive, the kibbut av'ayim that's talked about is a different nature. It's doing things that bring them honor, dedicate things in their memory, say kaddish, different things that you do to give weight. Literally kavod means weight, to give weight and to give honor to the parents. It's a whole different form of kavod. So to also there is an idea of kavod hanesh, that if people will respond when somebody is no longer alive, it's not right that there shouldn't be a reaction. It should be people who care, people who respond. So the fact that there is avelus, the fact that there is something going on in the aftermath, that is not only a comfort to those who mourn, it's also a kavod, both in that sense and in the more mystically oriented sense, to those who are no longer alive, which is similar to a concept that you find by Hesped. Hesped is really a different din. But the Gemara in the Seches Sanhedrin poses a question when it comes to Hesped. Do you say that Hesped, this idea of giving a eulogy, is it Yikara Dechaya or Yikara Deshchachva? Do you say that it is from the honor of those who are alive, or those who are at the honor of those who are no longer alive? Again, is it the idea that you want to show that the living should have this experience, or is it something that's done in honor of the person who passed away? And perhaps the most prominent difference that it would make is the whole discussion, what if somebody leaves instructions that he should not be eulogized? Somebody says that he doesn't want to have eulogies. Is he the person to listen to, or is it more for the family? So that's a discussion in post-Shulchan Aruch, is that a person does have the right to dictate that he shouldn't be eulogized. Some say that's only true if he's a private citizen, but if he was a Salvador, everybody would depend on, maybe it's a different role. We'll discuss about that. That's really a little bit tangential, since that you find that model by Hess, but it's a similar model that comes by Nephilim and Balaam also, that apparently there is both. There is, you're doing an act for the mourners, and you're doing it as well for the deceased. And in that sense, you find the concept is based on the Gemara, it's not explicit in the Gemara. The Rambam takes it a little bit further, that even if there are no mourners, even if there are no direct relatives, that a minion should go to the house where the deceased lived and should be there. So the Rambam says, the way the Rambam portrays it, they're basically taking on the role of substitute mourners. If there's no family to mourn, then this minion should come and mourn. The Rambam disagrees with it. It's not, as is often the case, he doesn't spell out exactly what he's upset about. You know, very often the Rambam says something, the Rambam says, no way. And then the commentaries have to say, what does he mean, no way, no way about this, no way about that. So he says there's no source for what the Rambam says. So there's a little discussion, what does he mean, there's no source? There's no source that they have a status of mourners, perhaps. Maybe the Rambam understood the Gemara to mean people should daven in the house. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're have a status of available. It's not clear what the Rambam's objection is, but the Rambam seems to portray it that people should volunteer to mourn on behalf of this individual if there's no family to do it. So Vital Stern points out in his Chuvas to Tel HaChachma that it's interesting. Generally, usually when you have a normal Shiva with a family, it's usually not a minion. It's usually not, usually aren't 10 male relatives who are in that family. It's pretty much often not the case. So how come if we have somebody who doesn't have a family, why require a minion? Let's have a handful of people go there and represent the idea of mourners. So he suggests that it's kind of a need to overcompensate, that if somebody doesn't have actual blood relatives who are mourning on their behalf, so then the need is kind of bumped up, and then it needs to be a minion, even though a real Shiva with their blood relatives, that's not necessarily the case. It is the case that many of people will come there to daven, but the mourners themselves are not going to necessarily constitute a minion. But this idea that kind of emerges from there of voluntary avails, even for non-relatives to come and decide they're going to donate their time as an avail, so you find that in other places. Also, the Rashba comments in the Gemara in the second parak of Brachas, the Mishnah there tells us that Rabban Gamliel had a servant named Tevi who he was very fond of, who he had a lot of esteem for, and when he passed away, he was Mekabel Tanchumin, I think. So the Mishnah says that he accepted condolences. It's not clear what exactly that means. So the Rashba understands it to mean that he's had Shiva, and that he decided that this was somebody he was close with and who he had a lot of esteem for, he could decide to voluntarily sit Shiva for. And Soloveitchik is quoted in some Svarim as suggesting that this is probably the appropriate model for adopted children. If you have an adopted child, so strictly speaking, there may not be an actual chiyuv of a velus. That's clearly appropriate, clearly it makes sense. So here's a case where it certainly seems indicated that the adopted children should voluntarily sit Shiva, should do the action of Shiva as a voluntary act, even if technically speaking it's not 100% obligated from the normal dim of blood relatives. So this all emerges from this Gemara, which is basically saying that the mace hovers in this area, and this idea that Rambam is building on it, that we see from there there's something that you're doing for the mace also, and that reflects itself in some of these examples. So you find that therefore the Rambam has a statement building on this again, that Yerali, he says, it seems to me, that because of this equation, that Bikur Cholim takes a backseat to Nichum Avelim. So we talked last week about Bikur Cholim, now we're moving up to Nichum Avelim, so we're going up in prayer. Nichum Avelim should come first. But because it performs these two roles, Chesed and Hamesh and Machai, therefore it takes priority over Bikur Cholim. And the Rabbaz, in his commentary over the Rabbaz, says he doesn't believe it, it's thought the exact opposite. Because when it comes to Bikur Cholim, as we discussed last week, there's understood to be an aspect of Pikuach Nefesh, that you're helping the person stay alive through this act of visiting. So it would seem to be that it should be prioritized more than Nichum Avelim. So some say, well, yes, that's true. What the Rambam is talking about is in a case where you can only do one. But if you can do both, then you should do Bikur Cholim first. So some point out that's the opposite of what you would think. That if you only do one, then you think Bikur Cholim should take the priority because that's the one that's quasi Pikuach Nefesh, or actual Pikuach Nefesh, depending on how you understand it. Well, Nichum Avelim, if you could do both, then okay, so fine, you'll do it after the Nichum Avelim. So it's a whole discussion on what exactly is the Chiddush of the Rambam, what is he trying to say, under what circumstances does he mean it. It's a little bit of a debate to the latest Svarim, but at least in theory, this is the impact, the statement that Rambam wants to say, that on some practical level, Nicham Avelim is going to take priority over Bikacholim, because Bikacholim has one beneficiary and Nicham Avelim has two. There is a discussion, Arsameach has a question on this. It's a question how much you have to worry about these kind of things. But, there's a lot of discussion about this. Arsameach says it sounds not like this from the Gemara and the Masechta Sukkah. Because Gemara and Sukkah, which is talking about something else, but it becomes a large part of this discussion, Gemara is talking about the Mitzvah of Lulav. And the Mitzvah of Lulav, the Gemara is telling us that even though we have an idea that you can fulfill Lulav really very minimally, you pick it up and you're done, but nonetheless, there's also an Indian to carry it around more, to be involved with it more than just that 1 second. So in that context, the Gemara says that the Anshei Yerushalayim, they would walk around all day and Chol Moed Sukkos with the Lulav, and they would holchem levakir asachola, holchem lenachem asavel, they would go to do all these things with the Lulav in their hands. So it's a question how you precisely you want to read that, but there are some answers, oh, you see what they do first, they went first to the Mavakar Asachola, and then Nisul Aveil. So again, you know, that's not the kind of thing that bothers everybody, but there's a lot of discussion prompted by the source of math about whether the way things are presented in that Gemara, whether that really makes a difference or not. So the result, you know, rather acronym, but Warman says like this also, it really relates back to this idea. Because yes, the Rambam is normally right, that Nicham Avelim is a dual idea, and therefore, normally it takes priority over Bikachol. But what's the context of this Gemara about Lulav? So by definition, it's talking about Yantif. It's happening on Sukkot. So in Yantif, really, we don't have Shiva. So the Shiva is really pushed off till afterwards. But it's still a little bit of an Indian, there's still a idea somewhat, primarily because of the Chesed and HaMesh. There is still the Neshama of the Mesh is still hovering during that time. So therefore, there's still an Indian to visit the Avelim without the full ritual of Shiva. So, but that's not the same priority as a normal Nicham Avelim would happen in a non-Yantif time. So when it's not Yantif, the Rambam's right that Nicham Avelim takes priority over Bikacholim. But because the Gemara is talking about Lulav on Sukkot, so therefore it says that in that context, Bikacholim takes priority over Nicham Avelim. Okay, that could be. So we all then can agree that Nicham Avelim is a high priority. So what exactly is involved in Nicham Avelim? So here the expression is perhaps a little bit understated. So we talk about making a Shiva call, making a Shiva visit. So it seems to be that in order to fulfill Nicham Avelim requires more than showing up. Even though from the source you find Prisha, for example, on the side of the page of the Torah, Prisha writes that just being there, that's a fulfillment of Nicham Avelim. But most others assume that not, you know, Bikur Chol, we talked about last week, different meanings of what Bikur could mean. But okay, Bikur also can roughly be translated as visit. Here the word is not visit, the word is to console, is l'nachem b'sa'aveilim. So apparently it probably requires more than simply being present, and it probably requires some level of conversation. So what exactly the conversation is, so that's a little bit of a discussion in of itself. So we know that there is a standard nusach that we're familiar with, ha'machim y'nachem b'shem b'sa'av sa'aveil z'yev y'ushalayim. This is a nusach prevalent in Ashkenazi communities. In Sari communities, they have a little bit of a different nusach. Ashkenazim and Ashkenazim, I think is the way it's phrased. Different versions of it. But this is just Hamakim Yenachem is one that we're familiar with in Ashkenazi communities. It's not explicitly like that in the Gemara. It develops a little bit later, but it's just found in earlier sources. And there is a lot of discussion about what this phrase is meant to convey. So to work backwards, if we end off by saying B'Sof Shadei L'Shiyam V'Yerushalayim, so that contains a couple of elements in it. First of all, we want to indicate that we always try to get Klal Yisrael involved. So the same way we take the Kibush HaBerach, we say someone should have the Refuah Shleima together with all the other Klal Yisrael. It's not just the individual, it's all of the Tzibur. So to here, we don't just comfort the mourner and leave it at that. We say B'Sof Shadei L'Shiyam, and then Shiyam V'Yerushalayim, the mention of Shiyam V'Yerushalayim. So some suggest that that's also meant to convey a message that, first of all, just like all the Klal Yisrael mourns over Shion and Yerushalayim, so too they share in this mourning as well. But also, so too, just as we believe that ultimately that mourning is going to end, it's going to be a redemption to Shion and Yerushalayim, so too there will be a relief to the suffering as well, and that that's meant to be conveyed through this phrase, B'Sof Shaveh Shion and Yerushalayim. So again, to work backwards, the phrase Eschem, is plural. Some discussion about it, is it intentionally plural or not. So some want to suggest, and you find the Sephardi expression Tanchum is also plural, some want to suggest that this again perhaps conveys this idea that we mentioned a few minutes ago, that there is a dual Nechama here, that perhaps we're addressing both the living and the deceased, and we're saying both of you, of Machnum and Hashem, both the living and the deceased, should both be comforted by this vision. Could be if that's really intentional, although when it comes to Tanchumu, for sure you find earlier versions that are phrased in the singular, you find discussion whether it should be phrased plural or not. That's a little bit questionable. This is really the intent of that phrase, or whether Hashem was meant to be that way. Not also, but in any event, that's certainly an interpretation that some have suggested. And it's interesting, tell you a personal ma'aseh shel Hayom. When I was in Karen V'Yavna, so the father of Rav Meir Goldbach passed away, who was the brother of the Rashi of Karen V'Yavna, the Chaim Yaakov Goldbach. They were sitting shiva together, the shiva and Rav Meir Goldbach. And I was very nervous about making a shiva call, because the minhag in Karen V'Yavna was certainly you always refer to the Rashiv in the third person. And I really wasn't sure what to do at the end, whether I should say, Hamak Menachem Eschem, you know, he comes for you, or did you say, Menachem Menachem Es Rashi Shiva? I really was very unclear about this. And so, in the end, I just kind of mumbled something and ran out. And I later found out that somebody showed me the Sefer Valeyu Lo Yibo that documents a lot of conversations that the author had with Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. And he writes there that he asked Reb Shlomo Zalman, he said, if somebody's going to see an Adam Gadol, somebody's going to see a prominent person who is normally referred to in the third person, should he say, Amokim Menachem Eschem, or should he change the text? And Shlomo Zalman said not to change the text. But then if they went on reading, explains the person is saying, because I'm not just asking Stam, I'm going to see Rabbi Goldfish. I want to know, should I say Machin Eschem Eschem? So it was actually the same shiva that I was going to. It happened to be the Goldfish brother, Rabbi Goldfish's father was very close to the Shlomo Zalman. It was the rabbi in his neighborhood, so it was all going on over there. So this same situation that I was misupik about is recorded in that sefer. It says that there was Shlomo Zalman said not to change the nusach. So I'm wondering, maybe it's, if you change the eschem to also, it's going to lose the plural. I don't know if that's partially the intent. I don't know what's behind his position. But maybe it's related to that. Then maybe there is an intentional meaning in this eschem, and so we don't play around with it. We leave it. Why do we say hamakom? It's not a pasuk. It's not in the Gemara either. You find some earlier sort of Maharil. You find some sources in the early Rishonim where there are different versions of it. It changes a little bit as it goes along. I could show you a literature where it exactly, but it's essentially, like I said, the Sephardim have a different expression. It doesn't have any inherent kedusha to it, but it has a history. It has a tradition. So there's some discussion. And again, it's not clear that it's intentional that the Deschem, but now that we have it, the theory is that it may relate to that. So the idea of Hamakom, why do we use that word? We know that Hamakom is a reference to the Kodesh Baruch Hu in general. Why all of a sudden at this occasion do we use Hamakom? So that there are a lot of theories about it as well also. Some suggest that it's a desire not to use God's name in connection with mourning, so we use a more vague reference. Others suggest that there is a Sliyajah Tshuva, that there's a whole idea of a Kodesh Baruch Hu created a special place in the Nechama after the Chorban HaBayis. And we're saying that that place, that makom that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created, that should be a source of nechama for you. Others say that the idea is that you're telling the mourners that they should know that this expression has in English, he's in a better place now. You want them to know that the mourner, that the deceased is no longer here, but is now enjoying the reward of their next world, whatever their well-lived life has earned them. So therefore, that should be a source of comfort to the mourners. You say, Hamakom, the place that they're in right now, the place is a better place, and that should be a source of comfort for you. And the Kli Yakar Taka writes in his commentary to Brace somewhere that that's the Ikar Nechama. You tell the mourner that the deceased is in a better place, that that's really what gives them comfort. And that's the intent of Hamakom Yachin. The Mikta of Noyo has a comment with Dashler that he wants to suggest a whole different idea. And this, again, it's, we just mentioned one popular expression. This is a different popular expression he wants to refute. So as you say, that time heals all wounds, so it's not true. He says, wounds would not naturally be healed by time. Certainly not emotional wounds. People would not get over a nifter naturally. It's only a special chesed from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's how they explain this week's parasha, that why Yaakov was not able to receive nechama over the loss of Yosef, because counterintuitively couldn't be comforted because Yosef was still alive. So he explains a gift that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives that really people can't get over these things, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives a gift that people should be able to get past it when it's true. And when it's not true, it's not there. So that's why Yaakov couldn't get past it. And so to here, so it's really not the natural progress of time that is what does it. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So that's the emphasis, is not the time, but Hamakom will do it. And we say place to distinguish from time. That's not the time. Time's not going to do it. It's the place being the capital P place, but also using that word to separate it from time. That's what's going to bring about the Nechama. So again, what exactly the source of this expression is, is a little bit of a discussion, but it seems that every word in the phrase may have some intent as far as accomplishing the Nechama. But even so, is any of this the actual Nechama? Could be this is a bracha. And the bracha that perhaps was learned from, again, HaKadosh Baruch Hu visiting Yitzchak, where the Torah tells us that he blessed him, so that maybe there's an Indian to give a bracha to the Avo. But this may not be the Nechama itself. Maybe the Nechama itself has to do with other aspects of conversation. And here you find that there is a big emphasis on what you say and knowing what you're saying. Of course, that's the skill. It's not something that's so easy, but it's something that is apparently required. The Gemara Maseches Brachos refers to a Beis Avel as a Beit Tamya, house of Tamya. So what does that mean? So the word Tam can mean a couple of things. It can mean reason. It can mean taste. And Rashi over there says that Matim and also Bedvarim, that again, however you translate the word Tam, you give him Tam with words, which could mean you give him reasons, it could mean that you give him taste, you give him meaning, and it could be that both of these meanings are relevant, that you have to say things of substance, things that will bring about a change of mind, a change of approach, and that's all crucial to the process. It's not something simple. It takes after. There's also a tradition that Reb Chaim Brisker has in a letter that was printed somewhere, a number of others have also, that there's an Indian on the Avol to accept it. It's not just that Menachem has to say it, but the Avol has to nod, has to somehow accept that this message is being conveyed, and that from some source is a mitzvah on him also. And part of this whole process of Nichum Avel, and they also point out, it's all basic, as Cordis Nainas, others said this as well, is to try to bring about healing not only in the emotional sense, but whatever else there is. So, for example, if a relative who passed away was a relative who was supporting the family, so to try to raise money to support the family is also an aspect of Nichum Avel, but that's also included in this process of trying to bring about comfort. There are some Achronim who suggested that if there are a number of Avelim sitting together, so to be Menachem them all at once, maybe that should be a concern of a principle we have of Ein Osa Mitzvahs Chavilus Chavilus. You don't do mitzvahs in packages, you don't try to kill two birds with one stone, and you try to do everything each in its own place. So Sternbach has a discussion about this once he dismisses that outright on technical grounds. That's not really the issue, but there's another issue. The issue is that Nichum Aveilim is a highly personalized experience, that it's something that every Avil is going to need a different type of treatment, and every Menachem is going to approach it differently. So therefore, for that reason, that's something to be concerned about, that really each person needs his own conversation, needs his own interaction with the Menachem. So for that reason, there's what to worry about when trying to deal with too many people at once. And the notion that this is not something we can accomplish so easily, the Rashba has in his tshuva, the famous tshuva of the Rashba, it's a Siman Yud Ches, in the first volume of the tshuva of the Rashba, where he has this tshuva about staka. The famous question of why is there no bracha on staka, different theories, why there's no bracha on staka. So the Rashba writes over there, the reason there's no bracha on staka is because we don't know what's going to happen. It could be you're going to offer the staka to somebody and he's not going to take it. So you're going to make a bracha and it's going to leave you hanging. So therefore, if that's what he means, why it's normally understood. So therefore, the principle kind of develops that any mitzvah that depends on somebody else, so you can't know you're going to do it, so therefore you shouldn't make a bracha, you don't know how it's going to turn out. He says, so today we come to Nichum Aveilim. You don't know if you'll be successful. You'll tell him, you'll try, you'll say something, and who knows what the result will be. So we can't really make a bracha on that because we don't know what's going to happen. You find also, therefore, different times have different recommendations as far as how you should go about it. There is a tradition in some Sfarim not to visit in the first 3 days. We don't really find that practice so much. It is recorded in some Sfarim. Some have it for Kabbalistic reasons. Some have it because it's supposed to be a more intense time of mourning the first 3 days. There's a discussion of Shlomo Kluger has. You say Mitzvah Yom Kikulo. You say that the third day is the beginning of the third day, if it's not the end of the third day. In any event, it's more likely that this is not the many to worry about this so much. And you find, as recorded in the Nice Farm, that many Gedolim took the opposite approach, that because there is at least somewhat of a remnant to this attitude, so very often it could result that the other will be left alone for the first 3 days, and that's the opposite of what we want. So therefore, there were many Gedolim who took it upon themselves to go Tavka during the first 3 days, because they're concerned that this impression would be that people would be left alone during that time. Sternbach, I think, writes in his Shuvas that even though if we assume we can go any of the times, but it may require a different type of attitude, that the first 3 days are more intense, the last four days are less intense. So again, understanding that Nichum Avelim is an art that requires some type of sensitivity to what's going on, so the first 3 days might require a different type than the last 4 days, and that's also something that's part of it. You do find a minig that's quoted as the Chuvus HaFarkasta D'Anya talks about this, with David Sperber. And this is clearly not the minig, but it's interesting that it's discussed. He records a minig not to be mevaker, not to be menachem aveilim at night. This is clearly not a minig. We probably make most teshuva calls at night, but nonetheless there is such a minig recorded. So some discussion about why this is. So some suggest that at night time people are more distraught and more emotional, and if the idea is you want to hope to have some level of success in the nechama, so you're not going to get through at night, and it's better to try during the day. Others suggest that it's just a practical concern, that by the night time the Avelim are tired and they want to go to sleep, and therefore for sensitivity to the Avelim, it's maybe not the best time, but that would be flexible depending on customs. So if people are in the habit of receiving guests at night, if that's the way people live their lives nowadays, so maybe it's not a problem. Maybe that could explain why this minig isn't really dominant minig, and that's the way Rabbi Nachum Yavrov wrote a Sefer Divrei Sofer Menachos Avelus, so he discusses that idea. And he also has a halachic suggestion. He says there is some basis for the belief that maybe Avelus at night is less stringent than the Avelus during the daytime. As Ramah says in Dadache Moshe somewhere, that if somebody has to leave his house during Avelus, it's better at night. At night there's a Hetzer L'Sarach to leave his house, and during the daytime, less so. So that seems to suggest that maybe the fee of Avelos is less at night during the daytime. Well, nice, you don't find really much of a distinction in the way people practice, but apparently there's a basis for this in the sources. And if that's the case, then maybe the idea of Nichum Avelim, you want to do it when it's really, when there's real Avelos. So if the Avelos is really in effect during the daytime, better to go then. And if that's the reason, then the nature of the minig would not be to discourage going at night. It would be to encourage going during the daytime. But certainly if somebody goes during the daytime and during the nighttime, there would be nothing to discourage about going at night. In any event, this doesn't seem to be the minig in our communities anyway, but there is some discussion, and it sheds a little bit of light about what this could possibly be about.
If you're going six times during the week, should you make an effort before you leave?
I think that is the practice, you know, to say that every time. Every time is a visit, every time and each time, so you want to at least go through the format. That is the practice. I mean, you know, what will happen if you don't? It's still a mitzvah, still a chesed, but there is still the format that seems to be associated. We do say, though, in a more, this is a little bit more serious, that with the Nichum Avelim doesn't really start until after the Kfur, which is a little awkward because people do interact with the family before that, certainly at the cemetery or at the funeral chapel. People have an opportunity to visit the family sometimes before, and it's a little awkward. That's officially not a time of Nichum Avelim. So hard enough for the Shiva to know what to say. It's, you know, harder then because it isn't really a format. And this is really based on a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. A Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos that Yarg is Adam B'Shas Kai, so you shouldn't take on a person when he's very angry. It's not going to be effective, and you shouldn't try to comfort a person. B'Shas Mason Mutal B'Fan of the time when the mourning is still fresh, when the loss is still fresh, when the person isn't buried yet. So it's not a time that's receptive for comfort. It's not a time where you're going to get anywhere. It's not a time where apparently it should even be attempted. And that's the protocol, which again is a little bit more than the idea of the first 3 days or the night, which for the minig is to not worry about so much. The idea of Nichum Avelim not really happening before the Kavura, that's a more solidly adhered to idea. which apparently is also rooted in this question of when will the comforting be effective. And apparently at that time it's not shaykh, and it's a little bit of an insult, a little bit of a disrespect to the deceased, who's still fresh, who's still not buried yet. He's, so to speak, at least in a halachic sense, right there in the room, and say, you know, don't cry about it. It's considered inappropriate. It's not really the time for it. There is also a protocol which here, this is also something which is a little more serious as far as the halachic sources, difficult as far as practice is concerned, but that's more a reflection of the way people relate to it than what's there. There's a din that really Avel is supposed to speak first, and that's not everybody is aware of, but that is the din that's based on the Gemara. Gemara has proofs from Eov about this. We'll be discussing what exactly that's about. Rav Lau, who is the chief rabbi, has a tshuva about this in his Sefer Yachal Yisrael. We'll discuss what exactly is the purpose of this halacha, this protocol that the Avil is supposed to speak first. So some say it's about Siddiq Adin, that the Avil has to publicly overcome his grief and at least be able to say something to show that he at least acknowledges God's justice, the fact he can still talk, he's not totally out of the picture. And then once he does that, so then Nichum can start. Others say that it's just, the Nichum can't start until Yavo expresses what he's holding. He has to express his grief, and then you can interact with him. But to try to start him off is inappropriate. And the discussion about what are some of the details of this, based on those who've started him, does it mean that he has to speak to every mourner, every visitor individually? He has to go to each one and start speaking to him first. Does it have to be Dafka speech, or can it be a sigh? Can it be an expression? Can it be a nod? So there is a discussion about that, which are all rooted in these reasons. Is it about the Siddiq Adin, which may require a different type of statement? Or is it about initiating the process, which may be a little bit less, could be sufficient as well? In any event, even though this is a serious concept, it is brought in the name of a number of Gedolim, including the Chazon Ish, and Shulyazer, Rabbi Yosef, a number of Edison, or whenever testimonies are quoted in the names of these Gedolim, that if they found that they came to a house and the Avil simply couldn't talk, he was overcome with grief, or in the case of considering who these people are, sometimes they're overcome by intimidation. If Chazon Ish comes to the house, so people feel they couldn't talk in front of Chazon Ish. So if they felt that he wasn't going to be able to talk, so then they would talk. They wouldn't be likuva if they felt that they weren't going to get anything out of them otherwise. They would talk, but not to minimize significance of the din. That really, normally, the status quo is that the Avil is supposed to speak first, but in circumstances where they see it's not happening, so many Gedolim have been witnessed by the practice of initiating if necessary. What you talk about is also important. So a lot of the Svarim point out, and this unfortunately is very often not observed, but this, you know, certainly is a serious idea, that the nature of the conversation is very much of an issue. It shouldn't be a frivolous conversation, and it shouldn't be joking around. It shouldn't be things that are inappropriate for a house of Avela. So there's a little bit of a point of departure. There are some of the later Achronim, some of the contemporary Svarim, argue that maybe a little bit of extraneous conversation is appropriate in order to settle the Avel down, in order to distract them a little bit, to calm them down. And others say, no, they're not supposed to be distracted. They're supposed to address it, and it's not right for the nature for them to be distracted. So everyone agrees that real frivolous conversation is inappropriate. There's some discussion about whether a little bit of discussion about mundane matters is perhaps helpful or is still inappropriate. But certainly anything beyond a little bit, something that really doesn't fit in a base level. You also find in the Gemara and in the Shulchan Aruch that, strictly speaking, the Menachemim are supposed to sit on the floor together with the Avil. So you don't find that happening. That doesn't seem to be our minhag. They don't sit on the same level. But the idea that you should be sitting down, that you do find Svarim at least recommending for any range of ideas. It shows the kviyas, it shows that you're not running out, you plan on sitting with them, and it shows an identification. You want to feel that you're with them. You want to feel that both you're there for a few minutes, take your coat off, you're going to sit down, and that you're feeling an identification with them. So to those ends, to be sitting down is certainly at least recommended. It's not, again, doesn't mean that you're not sitting and not yoked to anything, but it is an Indian that's also discussed in Svarim. Another point some of the contemporary Svarim disagree about, the question of, is it appropriate for the mourners to be comforting each other? So that, some say it's not really right. They're not supposed to distract themselves from their own process. They're supposed to receive company from the others, from the non-mourners. And others say, no, that that's the Iker Nechama. Yimcha Anochi B'tzara. A person says, I'm literally going through the same thing you're going through. That's really the greatest type of Nechama a person can give. And that is appropriate. Just two points which overlap with Bikacholim topics. So we discussed last week that there is an extensive discussion about can you fulfill Bikacholim with a phone call. And as I mentioned, it's a little bit extensive because the same person asked a number of poskim, therefore a number of the tshuvas to talk about this are all addressed to the same guy. So one person is responsible for a lot of discussion. He's also responsible for a lot of this discussion because he asked the question together. He's a phone for a call for Bikacholim or for Nicham Avelim. So is it effective or not? So here you have a lot of the same overlapping elements, but there are some differences. Some of the posts can point out that they don't think it really fits at all. First of all, for the dual element, the element of Bikur Cholim and Nichum Avelim with the living and with the dead, so you're not doing anything for the deceased or the phone call. You're doing a little bit for the living, but it's not accomplishing the dual in you, so it's certainly not fulfilling that. And the halacha we just talked about, the idea that the Avel is supposed to speak first, that's very hard to do if you're calling them. And it's really a serious point because you can't follow certain protocols with a phone call and you can't gauge where the phone. I had it today that I had to call somebody who I wasn't able to get to, as many hours away. And it's not the same thing. It's a very awkward experience and you can't see how they're reacting. You can't, they're forced to speak to you when you want to speak to them. And, therefore, a lot of posts can really thought, look, it's maybe better than nothing, but it's really not what the mitzvah of Nichum Avelim is. And a real about face, mentioned last week that a footner thought, when it comes to Bikur Cholim, he was more for that than all the other posts can work, because Bikur Cholim is about looking into the condition of the Cholim. You can call the game, you can totally fulfill Bikur Cholim, which was farther than most of the other posts can felt, but it was a little bit, but not everything. When it comes to Nichum Avelim, he says, totally not. It's nothing, because there it's about joining into this whole structure of the base Avel, and then you're really not accomplishing that at all. A similar point is raised when it comes to letters. When it comes to letters, a lot of these problems are actually not as much because the Avel can choose when to read the letter, when to open it up, when to spend time with it. You don't have to worry about becoming a tirach on him. So some of these points are actually mitigated from the issue of letters. But it prompts another question that some folks can talk about. What if you write the letter and only gets to him after Shiva? So then you don't fulfill that aspect of Nichum Avelim that applies during Shiva, but there is a Nichum Avelim that goes after Shiva, which is a whole discussion in itself, which we won't get into so much now. But you know, the Iker Nichum Avelim is during Shiva, but certainly Shloshim of the time of Avelis, and for a parent, Yubeis Chodesh time of Avelis also. So there is something that's accomplished then, but the Iker time is during Shiva. After the time of Avelis is over, after the year or after the month, the Gemara says the person who engages and Nichum Avelim after Avelis is over, it's just like a person, it's a very interesting muscle the Gemara gives, like somebody who comes and breaks your leg and says, let me show you what a good doctor I am, I can fix your leg. And the Nimshal is, and then here the person is hopefully is past it, and you're trying to kind of remind them of the Tsar, so then you can comfort them about it. So that's considered to be more self-serving than really effective. The presumption is the person is not so grief-stricken that it's still affecting them later on, which is a different issue. But if the presumption that person comes and resuscitates the issue, so that's considered to be inappropriate. But after Shiva, there's still Shloshim, so if the letter grade gets there after Shiva, it's certainly going to at least accomplish that. That's a discussion as well as connected to the whole letter thing. A second point that we mentioned,
which is still
saying that's not the practice, it's just to be a Shiva. But again, it's all it's all a tradition. It seems to not be associated with that. When it comes to another point that we mentioned also with Bikur Cholim is the question, unfortunately, of a shone. If a person is an enemy, he doesn't get along. So it's a question whether or not that visit should happen. As we mentioned, that Ramah wasn't so excited about it. He thought that maybe it will look like you're gloating if you show up at your enemy's house when they're suffering. Another said that maybe it could be an opportunity for peacemaking, and it really all depends on the level of animosity that's there, and also maybe it should be cleared beforehand, and then proceeding accordingly. Some point out that here again, the whole dual issue comes into play also, because if it's supposed to be a festive for the mace, So then maybe you could say, well, listen, I'll go and the visitor don't get along, but he comes with Chabad the Mesh, maybe he should come anyway. Or the other way around, you know, if he didn't get along with the Mesh, but he gets along with the Avil, so maybe at least it's half a mitzvah. Of course, you could figure out that if it's going to come to a fight, if there's going to be a Machlokes place going on, that's not going to be a Chabad the Mesh in any sense of the word. So that's why not, if they're going to get Kuli High, if it's really a risk of it being a confrontational experience, and it's not going to be appropriate on any level. I'll just end with one other point that we normally find, and discuss this a little bit in the broader rubric of Chesed, but we normally find that when we try to weigh the issue of Talmud Torah versus any mitzvah, the general rule is one's not exempt from the mitzvah because of the Torah study, unless it's a mitzvah that's actually the Echerim. But if it's a mitzvah that other people are going to do, so then the person should keep learning. So when it comes to Nicham Avelim, you don't really find this exemption applied at all. The general assumption is that it's never after Lashes L'Deachem. And that's true for a couple of reasons. It's true that every additional visitor increases the covered both of the mourner and of the mace, so everybody can play a role that it's not going to be there if they're not there. But also, fundamentally, and perhaps more importantly, because of what we said before, that the whole Nichum process is a very personal thing that has to do with the interaction between the visitor and the Avel. And no other person can accomplish what you can accomplish. No other individual by coming is going to create the same type of Nechama. So therefore, it's fundamentally not a mitzvah zeshir lasos v'deacher, and it can't be done by others. And therefore, you don't really find this exemption really applying at all. You know, certainly, obviously, you can't go to shidduch houses all day, but people who you come in contact with, people who you have a relationship with, you know, and they could contribute to a nechama by being there, so you don't find an exemption at all for Talmud Torah in this case. Okay, so maybe we're just about out of time, so to quickly review what we spoke about. We spoke about the fact this is essentially a mitzvah minat Torah. The Rambam's mysterious formulation acknowledged as well, but the most part probably a mitzvah minat Torah, and one that Kosh Baruch Hu models. Talked about the idea that the Rambam says it's a double chesed for the Mesh and for the Chai. The Gemara has this idea that Neshama is hovering around, but also in a more down-to-earth idea that the covenant for the Mesh that people respond, and therefore, as the Rambam writes, that even if there's no Avelim, 10 men should come and make a minyan in the house, as he puts it, to be substitute mourners, but I disagree with some element of that. And this leads us into the idea of voluntary shiva, where we find that perhaps Rabbi Gamliel is doing for his servant, and we find the Rav recommending that adopted children should do for their parents, because certainly it's appropriate on that level. And we talked about the Rambam's therefore saying that Bikur Cholim takes a backseat to Nicham Avelim, because Nicham Avelim is double, a whole question about whether Bikur Cholim being some type of Bikur Lach Nefes, a discussion where and why that exactly applies. And there are some next questions, the Gemara says, with the Lubav, that they went to visit the sick and enter the Menachem Avelim, but then there's being into it, but that's what the impression of the Gemara is. So in many Acharonim explaining this, because the dual idea doesn't apply on Yantif, because there's no actual Shiva on Yantif, it's just the idea of Menamech, so that applies, so it's a single element, but the idea of Menachem is not really applying at that time. And then we talked a little bit about what does it mean to be Menachem Avelim. The Prisha says coming is a Kiyam, but presumably it really involves more than that. There's this Nusach of Amakom Menachem. We talked a little bit about the significance of each of those phrases. Why do we mention with Yerushalayim? Why do we mention with all the mourners of Yerushalayim? Why do we say Aschem in the plural? Maybe that reflects the idea of the Chaim in the Mason. We talked about this idea of an Adam Gadol. We don't change Nusach according to Yerushalayim Zalman. And different theories to why do we say Hamakom instead of a more usual word for Hashem. Either not to associate Hashem's name with tragedy, or because it conveys the idea that there's a place of Nechama, or because the place in the next world is itself in Nechama, or because place in contrast with time. Different theories all how this phrase is meant to convey a type of Nechama. Beyond that, that's really the bracha at the end. There is the body of the comforting, which is a whole different discussion. You mentioned the Gemara's phrase of Beit Tamia, different ways you can read what that means. You give them tam, you give them meaning, you give them taste, whatever it is. All suggests there has to be a certain substance. And Reb Chaim has this idea also that they have to respond, they have to answer and accept it. We also discuss the idea that you're supposed to try to comfort them, not just emotionally, but make up for whatever's lacking. So the person was the moneymaker, and he tried to raise money and things like that. Talked also about the idea of Enosu Mitzvah Chavilus Chavilus. Is that a concern or not? And as Rav Shembach points out, technically speaking, that's not the problem. But the problem is that every Avol needs his own approach, and therefore, for that reason, it's kedai to do everybody separately. We talked about the Rashba's Tshuva. Well, you don't make a bracha on Yichum Avelim because maybe you're not going to succeed. We talked about the minhagim, which may or may not be observed, of not going in the first 3 days, of not going at night. Why would what were the possible reasons for not going at night? Too emotional, too tired, it's not real avelus, and the like. And we talked about the din of not being minhagim before the kvura, and that's based on Mishnah and Avos. And we talked about the idea of the avel has to speak first, and different theories as to why that is, either if it's tzedakah din or it's initiation of the process, and that could affect what exactly do we require in this area, and the fact that if it's not happening, so then the visitor will speak first. And I talked about the idea of what the conversation should be, how it shouldn't be frivolous, that was appropriate maybe to do a little bit of distraction, and whether it is appropriate or not was a little bit of a debate. And we talked about the idea that the mourner is officially, the guest is officially supposed to sit down with the mourner. We don't find them sitting on the floor with the mourner, but the idea of sitting, we do find encouragement both to show that you're there, the kvius, and to show identification. Identification is also the issue as far as whether mourners should comfort each other or not. There also you find different opinions in posting. And we talked about the question whether a phone call is effective, how a lot of postmen felt phone calls really missing a lot because it's not accomplishing anything for the mage. So also you can't have them although speak first, you can't have the although gauge when he wants to speak or doesn't want to speak. So a phone call is lacking a lot. Letters are actually a little bit better in this area, don't have some of these problems, but both of them are probably missing a lot if a personal visit is possible. And then we talked about the question of a person who's an enemy, the whole Ramah Ma'aril story. And here also the dual component may also affect that equation somewhat. And then we talked about the fact that there isn't really an exemption for Talmud Torah, and that seems to be because it's never actually asked for Be'acherim, because every additional guest adds to the covenant, both the Chayim and the nation, and every personal friend is able to make a contribution to Mechama that no other person can make, and therefore it's never considered to be actually asked for Be'acherim. Okay, so we will see what the next topic will be in light of Jesus. Then I will wish you a wonderful evening. And that's good.